understood from Atma was that we're on 646.
Yep, that's the one. I'm going to see if we have Anita's back here.
Okay. I'm going to do 646 and 647. I hope I don't get arrested.
So if y'all have a Gita, you can follow along. If not, maybe share with a neighbor or just listen.
This verse, I really like talking about these two particular verses. These are, I think, very key verses in Bhagavad Gita. And I'm happy that somehow or another time and tide coincided to let me talk about these two verses, because these are the last two verses of the sixth chapter. Tapas vibhyo diko yogi gyanibhyo pimato dikaha karmibhyas chadiko yogi tasmad yogi bhavarjuna. Tapas vibhyo diko yogi gyanibhyo pimato dikaha karmibhyas chadiko yogi tasmad yogi bhavarjuna. The yogi is better than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruitive worker. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. A yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruitive worker. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. And what kind of yogi should you be? The next verse tells. Yoginam api sarvesham madgantain antaratvanam shradavam bhajate yomam same yuktatamo mataha. And of all yogis, the one with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. And of all yogis, the one with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So, gosh, I think I'm going to need
more water.
Yeah, I just ate earlier today, and that usually puts me in this kind of eye down glasses and glasses of water for a while, and then I stop. But I haven't gotten finished with the downing glasses and glasses of water yet. All right, so this is the sixth chapter. One of the things I like to make people aware of is the Bhagavad Gita is broken into three sections, and they're equal, like the first six chapters, the middle six chapters, and the last six chapters. So since there's 18 chapters in Bhagavad Gita, one-third of it, one-third of it, plus one-third of it.
Three.
Oh, my gosh.
There's glasses and glasses.
We'll see if I make my way through all that. That may be overmuch, but it could also be about right. We'll see how it goes. The first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is just trying to get on the same page with Arjuna. Arjuna has heard some things about the Vedic system. Everybody in Arjuna's time learned something about the Vedic system. Particularly, Arjuna is a Kshatriya. So, like Brahmanas, Kshatriyas also had to have a lot of training in the Vedic knowledge because they had to apply the Vedic knowledge. They weren't just people who were big armed and, you know, able to muscle people around, but they had to actually understand what Dharma was and how to execute justice. So they had to understand the Vedic literature. And Arjuna and his brothers, Yudhishthira, Bhimsen, and Nakula and Sahadeva, they grew up in the forest because their father wasn't a, desk job kind of guy. Their father, Pandu, didn't like being in the palace, with servants waiting him. He wanted to be out in the field. He wanted to be with people. He wanted to be in the forest. He wanted to be particularly with the sages. So that's where they grew up. And they learned a lot about Vedic knowledge at an early age. And that was a good thing. But obviously, like today, if you learn Vedic knowledge on your own without a teacher, without somebody guiding you through it, you will naturally not know what's important and what's not important. And quite likely you'll get the wrong impression. So Arjuna has gotten a good sense of the wrong impression, and Krishna is just kind of fast-forwarding through the Vedic literature, and he's hoping to get on the same page with Arjuna. Now he'll discuss all the various different aspects of importance in the Vedas. And in this chapter, chapter 6, the last two verses, Krishna finally gets around to explaining to Arjuna what he really thinks about the Vedas and what's the most important with these last two verses. So he's talked about all this other stuff, but with the last two verses, Krishna finally states his own preference. And after that, then with the middle six chapters, Krishna begins to unfold what he means by being a bhakti yogi. So in the beginning, it's not clear exactly what the highest thing is. Krishna kind of smorgasbords through a whole bunch of things. He talks about Sankhya Yoga. He talks about Karma Yoga. He talks about Jnana Yoga. He talks about Dhyana Yoga. He talks about Buddhi Yoga. He talks about all these different things. And you get the impression that it's kind of like a smorgasbord. Whatever you like, you just kind of put some of it on your plate, and that's where you go. Off and away you are. But that's not actually Krishna's real understanding. At the end, with these last two verses of the sixth chapter, Krishna says that tapasvibhyo diko yogi. So a yogi is better than the tapasvi, which is the person who is an ascetic. Tapas means austerity. So a person who performs austerity, the yogi is better or greater than the ascetic. Jnanibhyo pi mato dikaha, that he is better than the jnani. So he explains that the yogi is better than the jnani. Then he has, what's the third one there? Karmibhyas chadiko yogi. Karmibhyas chadiko yogi. So the yogi is better than the karmi. Then tasmad yogi bhavarjuna. Therefore, tasmad yogi, a yogi, bhava, you become Arjuna. You become a yogi, therefore you become a yogi. So it's clear now, after Krishna's talked about karma yoga, he's talked about jnana yoga, he's talked about sankhya yoga, he's talked about dhyana yoga, he's saying, therefore be a yogi. And you might think that he's encouraging Arjuna to do some kind of meditation. But the next verse explains what kind of yogi Arjuna is supposed to become. And then we have Yoginam api sarvesham madgantain antaratmanam shradavam bhajateyo mam same yuktatamo mataha. So that the last verse says, and of all yogis, one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So, first of all, in verse 46, Krishna tells Arjuna to become a yogi, which is better than these other things that they've been talking about. And then in verse 47, he tells him what kind of yogi to become. And this is a bhakti yogi. So, there are many versions of Bhagavad Gita on the market. You can get them in bookstores. Prabhupada said at the time that he wrote his Bhagavad Gita, there were 800 versions. So I assume there must be scads more than that now. And, Prabhupada wrote a Bhagavad Gita. He called it Bhagavad Gita as it is, because he wanted to give the original basic thrust of Bhagavad Gita, which is an explanation of bhakti. There's a man who wrote a Bhagavad Gita as it was. I'm not kidding. There really is a Bhagavad Gita as it was. And it only has, I think, about 10 chapters in it or something. I wonder what happened to the other chapters. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi also left out everything past the sixth chapter. He kind of ended at chapter 6. And he said that one of these days he was going to get around to doing the other chapters, but of course he's not with us anymore, so he's never going to get around to doing the other chapters. But The whole Bhagavad Gita works together in its explanation of the concept of bhakti. And Arjuna here is being told to be a yogi, and then he's being told to be a yogi who bhajas or worships. And this is interesting, because the word there is bhaj, which is a verb in Sanskrit. It means to worship. It's very different than the word dhyan, which means to meditate. And this chapter, chapter 6, has been actually very strongly focused on the concept of meditation. The whole chapter is about meditation, meditation, meditation. From all the way from verse 20 to verse 32, Krishna gives the nuts and bolts of the meditational system. He talks about sitting cross-legged and staring at the tip of the nose and getting a seat that's not too high and not too low and trying to focus within. All these things are described in this chapter. So sometimes this chapter is called the Dhyana Yoga, and of course that's the way it's labeled in this Bhagavad Gita. Sometimes this chapter is also called Sankhya Yoga, but in our books it's called Dhyana Yoga. Then it talks about the meditational system. Why would Krishna be talking about meditation? Well, Arjuna has suggested, he did way back in the first and second chapter when Arjuna is giving his objections to the battle of Kurukshetra. Arjuna is objecting to fighting the battle of Kurukshetra, and he's suggesting that better if the Kurus kill me unarmed and unresisting, and he's suggesting that he goes into the forest. He doesn't say it. I was looking for it the other day to see if Arjuna actually says somewhere in Bhagavad Gita that he plans to meditate. He doesn't actually say that in so many words, at least as far as I can remember or I found. But because he's suggesting he goes into the forest, what do people in the forest do? They meditate. At least those people who are going into the forest for spiritual purposes, they go to the forest to meditate. So that's why Arjuna has suggested instead of fighting, he should meditate. And so then Krishna talks about all these other things, karma yoga, jnana yoga, astanga yoga, so on and so forth. And now he's suggesting that he become a yogi, but not the kind of yogi most people think. He's suggesting he become a yogi who worships. So what's kind of a little bit misleading in chapter 6 is that Krishna is using the word yoga in two different ways, or he's describing two different yoga systems without actually explaining which one he's describing. And in fact, he's describing both systems. He's kind of saying things that equally apply to the system we usually think of as Dhyana Yoga, and they also apply to the system we speak of as Bhakti Yoga. So this chapter 6... many of the verses could even be Krishna talking about bhakti yoga, or they could be Krishna talking about dhyana yoga. He says, focus on the supreme. So the dhyana or meditational yogi, he focuses on the supreme. How does he do it? He performs austerities. He engages in activities that purify his consciousness. Then he performs hatha yoga. And then after performing hatha yoga, he performs pranayama. He drills the life airs. After drilling the life airs, he slows the mental process down. After slowing the mental process down, he begins to visit the various chakras or energy centers in the body. And finally, he comes to the heart chakra, and he sees the Supreme Lord seated on the heart chakra as a super soul with a four-armed form. And in that way, the meditational or dhyana yogi meditates on the supreme. The bhakti yogi also meditates on the supreme, but he does not use that procedure to do it. Rather, the bhakti yogi is out in the world doing things. He is not in a meditational position. He is not performing pranayama or any of those things. The bhakti yogi, he is engaged in things of the world, but he's also always thinking about Krishna, but he's doing it in a different manner. He's actually doing it actively. by using his sensory facilities for Krishna and doing things with the intent of pleasing Krishna. That's how the bhakti yogi does it. And so if you read chapter 6, you'll notice that many of the verses could apply to either of those two yoga systems. They could apply to the traditional dhyana yoga system, or they could apply to the bhakti yoga system. There are a few verses there that definitely only apply to the dhyana yoga system, like sitting on kusha grass, staring at the tip of the nose. That only the dhyana yogis do. And sometimes people wonder why we as Hare Krishnas, we don't do much yoga. Some of us do, but not very many of us do. Why we don't. So we are performing yoga, and we're performing a kind of yoga called bhakti yoga, which is an active yoga. It does not involve meditation, but rather it involves trying to serve the Supreme Lord with our body, mind, and words. One of the things that's interesting here is someone could say that, well, you know, here's this whole chapter, it's talking about yoga, and Krishna is obviously talking in some places about the whole concept of meditational yoga. So obviously Krishna wants Arjuna to be a yogi, that kind of yogi. But practically speaking, we see that when the Bhagavad Gita is finished, Arjuna does not sit down and perform bhakti yoga. What does Arjuna do instead? He gets right into a battle, which is not an example of the dhyana yoga system, but is actually an example of the bhakti yoga system. So if that was a yoga that Krishna had intended, Arjuna missed the point, and the Bhagavad Gita ended. So from a practical perspective, we see that Krishna is bringing forward these various Vedic systems, highlighting them, telling Arjuna a little bit about them, and then finally in this chapter, at the very end, these two last verses, Krishna is describing what he really wants Arjuna to do. So any questions about that? I'll just pause here for a minute. Anybody have any questions about that much of it before I rocket into some of the other stuff that I hope to talk about tonight? Yeah, you have a question.
Stages of purification in order to get in contact with the super consciousness and Lord. How does a bhakti yogi do that? Do you go through some sort of cleansing?
We do go through a cleansing. And bhakti yoga is described in Srimad Bhagavatam in 7th canto. We have Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmini, Videnam, Iti Pum Sarpita, Vishna, Bhaktas, Chen, Navalakshana, Kriyate, Bhagavati Adhau, Tanmanye, Dihi, Tamu, Tamam. That's Prahlad Maharaj talking to his father, Hiranyakashipu, big demon. And Prahlad has just been asked by his father, what's the best thing you learned in your demon school? And Prahlad says this, and he's describing bhakti yoga, shravanam kirtanam, hearing and chanting. So that's what bhakti yogis do. They hear and chant. Shravanam means to hear. Kirtanam means to chant. Vishnu smarana means to remember Vishnu. Padasevanam means to serve the lotus feet of the Lord. Archanam means to perform worship, usually on the altar with deity paraphernalia. Archanam. Vandanam means to offer prayers. Sakyam means to become a friend. Ardasya means to become a servant. Sakyam means to become a friend. And Atmini Videnam means to give up everything. So our good friend Atma, that's his name, Atmini Videnam. He is the ninth process of bhakti yoga. So there are nine processes: hearing, chanting, remembering, serving, worshiping, and praying, becoming a servant, becoming a friend, and giving up everything to the Lord. These are the activities of bhakti yogis. And we notice that it's not quite as systematic and mechanical as the system that we usually think of as Ashtanga yoga, the eightfold yoga practice, which starts with yam and niyam. Most people in the modern world have never heard of the yam niyam part. They start right away from hatha, you know, which is the actual third stage of the Ashtanga system. So you have yam and niyam, the third stage is hatha, then fourth stage is pranayam, then the stage after that is pratyahara, then there's dharana, then there's dhyana, and finally samadhi. So those are progressive stages. Prabhupada describes it as a mechanical system. It's actually more about being very meticulous in working the various material senses so that one becomes very peaceful internally in their consciousness. And then when you become very peaceful, you can begin to work with the life airs, begin to work with the energy channels, and finally, as I was saying, you become able to witness the supersoul within the heart. And so that's the procedure of Ashtanga yoga. It has those eight steps. But the bhakti yogi, he has nine processes. They're not steps, really. They are alternatives, you know. And so a person who's a bhakti yogi bounces back and forth between these eight or nine different kinds of things. At any time, they may be doing one or two, or maybe doing one at one time, another one at another time. Sometimes they're hearing, sometimes they're chanting, sometimes they're hearing and chanting, sometimes they're hearing, chanting, and remembering at the same time. When you're chanting Hare Krishna, you're actually doing all three of those things at the same time. And sometimes they're doing some service, sometimes they're doing some puja, sometimes they're doing some prayer. And sometimes there, the three last ones, you know, dasyam, sakyam, and atmini vidhanam, those are kind of higher levels of the bhakti process, where one has actually begun to become intimate with the Supreme Lord. So then you become a servant, become a friend, you've given up everything for the Supreme Lord. So these are kind of alternatives. And the bhakti yogi does not try to control the senses in the same fashion as the dhyani yogi does. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions anybody has about that part? Yeah.
Yeah, if the supersoul is located on the heart, what happens?
What happens with people? Prabhupada was asked that question one time, you know. He said, suppose you're in a room and you're sitting on a chair, and somebody says, I have to take that chair, here's another chair. So what do you do? You get up and somebody switches the chair and you sit back down in the chair. So the heart is a physical thing, and it's also a energy thing, and the two things are not the same thing. So the living entity is said to be seated in the heart. And so there's a mechanical pump, and that can be changed by doctors when there's necessity. But there's also an energy chakra, which is part of the being or the person, and that doesn't change the same way. And the soul certainly can just change from one pump to another if it's necessary. Does that make sense at all? At least that's kind of a simple way to understand it. The physical self is usually what people identify with. But the physical self is only a kind of external part of who we really are. Doctors and people in physics only understand a certain aspect of the human self. You know, the human self is much larger than the organs or cells or tissues that make up the body. It's much larger even than the set of habits and quirks that make up our personality. The self is actually much more than these things, and the self is something that is transcendental to the body, so that when we die, the self moves to another body. It has no problem, what to speak of, moving when a heart gets moved in and out of the same body. It can move to a completely new body. And that's called the cycle of reincarnation. So when we reincarnate, something called the subtle body leaves the gross body, and the subtle body then enters into a new gross body. And the previous old gross body, once the energies of the soul leave it, all that chemistry that was unhappy being together starts to go its separate ways. We know what happens to bodies when the living entity dies, you know. What's really happened is the energies that held that body and all of its chemistry together like a glue, once that energy field is gone, then the body simply starts to decompose. And so now that subtle body is being driven towards another location, another body somewhere. Usually that's what happens, and that's what we call the cycle of reincarnation. So you have an energy field, which is called the subtle body, and you've got the soul, which is even something different than the subtle body. And the soul within the subtle body traveled to another body at the time of new birth after a previous death. That makes sense? Any other quick questions, and then we can, yeah.
I'm just really new to this. Basically, chanting, hearing, and serving. What's been happening is now I just have this constant humming and vibration of just the Hare Krishna. I don't know the other
mantras
stuff, you know, only in English. I don't know the what you were saying. Just chanting Hare Krishna, for some reason now it's vibrating in my body, in my mind, in my head, in my ears, ever since I began. I'm talking about within a week, and for some reason it's just now this constant vibration.
Krishna's had some mercy on you.
I've been told that, yes.
Other people tell me that phenomenon too, that they experience that. That sometimes they just start thinking about the holy name and it just kind of seems to automatically be going on. That's a good thing. We're being purified by that. Okay, so chapter 6. We want to do a quick review because we're at the end of the chapter here. It starts off with four verses, the first four verses of chapter 6. Krishna is trying to get Arjuna to understand that one should work, but one should work without attachment. That's been a theme all the way through from chapter 2 to chapter 3 to chapter 4 to chapter 5. At the beginning of chapter 6, Krishna is still kind of reiterating this theme because Arjuna didn't get it. He doesn't get it in chapter 3, and he doesn't seem to get it even in chapter 5. You know, in chapter 5, Arjuna asks almost the same question that he asks in chapter 3. And the same question is there about the difference between work and knowledge, as if the two are opposite things. To do work means you aren't in knowledge, or if you're in knowledge means you don't do work, which is a common misconception. But actually it's not the fact. We can work and we can be in knowledge at the same time. In fact, a person who is in actual knowledge does work. He does not refrain from working. A person who is in actual knowledge works. But he doesn't do any kind of thing. He does only certain kinds of things. And the certain kinds of things that he does is he does actions that serve the Supreme Lord. That's how a person in proper action actually works. He does not work in some kind of materialistic or random way. The person in knowledge does work, but he does work without accepting the results of his actions. He acts for Krishna, and he doesn't try to absorb the fruits of his action. Oh, that's an important point. And then from 5 to 9, that's that interesting section where Krishna tells Arjuna about the mind. The mind is our best friend or our worst enemy, you know. This is that little, you know, kind of gremlin thing that we live with all the time that beats us over the head with all kinds of nasty stuff. And we always just let it usually do its little trip. And one day we figure out that this thing is kind of out of control and we need to do something about it. And so then we learn how to control the mind. And so yoga, whenever you're talking about yoga, that's something you usually don't hear or understand in most yoga, modern yoga schools, is that yoga means sense control. It means mind control. Sense control, mind control, the same thing. Sense control means that we direct our senses towards certain things and away from other things. If we don't, then our life will be kind of out of control. We will be pulled around by whatever powerful sense stimulus is the most near to us at that moment. And that's not a very intelligent way to live, to be pulled by whatever sensory stimulus is the most powerful at that moment. So we control our senses. To control our senses means we have to control our mind. In our Brooklyn Bhagavad Gita class, we've been talking about this whole idea of the mind, you know, by contemplating objects of the senses, one develops attachment. From attachment, lust arises. From lust, anger arises. From anger, delusion arises. From delusion, bewilderment of memory. And when memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost and one falls down into the material pool. So it's a downward progression. By letting the mind orbit any and every kind of thing, we become attracted first and then attached. And then finally, we become so fixed on something mentally that if something interferes with us getting that thing, we become immediately agitated. And when we become agitated, we become actually gradually dehumanized. Someone who constantly is angry, they become essentially dehumanized. You know, they don't remember things. They don't see the world around them in any kind of practically clear way. Everything is confused to them. And that's what we mean by, and when memory is lost, well, and one becomes angry, one loses memory, and when memory is lost, when memory is gone, intelligence is lost, and one falls down. So when we allow anger to get carried away, anger actually blots out our memory, and when our memory is blotted out, essentially our intelligence is blotted out. So this is a downward thing. So to control the senses, one has to actually control the mind. And everybody controls the mind, but people usually don't think of it that way. When somebody is going to college and, you know, they're studying for their final exams and the next day there's their final exams and a friend comes out and says, hey, the football game's on. And they think, well, I can watch the football game, but then I'll blow up my final exams. No, I'll let you go on that one. You know, I've got to study, you know. So this is controlling the mind. We've pulled the mind away from one kind of thing to something else. And so everybody controls the mind to some extent. But most of us never realize how important it is to control the mind and discover what kind of thing the mind focuses on, because the mind is like the rudder of a big ship. Whichever way the rudder points, eventually the ship's going to head that direction. So whatever we allow ourselves to think about over and over again, that's, in no uncertain terms, going to be where our future is going to go. You know, whatever we think about a lot is where our future is going to wind itself up. So if you're not aware of what you're thinking, that means you don't notice where your future is going to wind up. And if you are aware, then you can make some reasonable decisions on whether certain things are worthwhile to have your future go that way. So this is basically from verse 5 to verse 9 in the 6th chapter. Krishna talks about this idea of controlling the mind. The mind is the best friend or the worst enemy. Any questions about the mind before we move on into the next part of chapter 6 as a review? So then from verse about 10 through 32, then Krishna describes the actual nuts and bolts of the yoga system. We get this kind of stuff. A transcendentalist should always engage his body, mind, and self in relationship with the Supreme. He should live alone in a secluded place and should always carefully control his mind. He should be free from desires and feelings of possessiveness. To practice yoga, one should go to a secluded place and should lay kusha grass on the ground and then cover it with a deer skin and soft cloth. The seat should be neither too high nor too low and should be situated in a sacred place. The yogi should then sit on it very firmly and practice yoga to purify the heart by controlling his mind, senses, and activities and fixing his mind on one point. One should hold one's body, neck, and head erect in a straight line and stare steadily at the tip of the nose. Thus, with an unagitated, subdued mind devoid of fear, completely free from sex life, one should meditate upon me within the heart and make me the ultimate goal of life. Here Krishna is more or less describing the dhyana yoga process. Here's text 15. Thus, practicing constant control of the body, mind, and activities, the mystic transcendentalist, his mind regulated, attains to the kingdom of God or the abode of Krishna by cessation of material existence. There's no possibility of becoming a yogi or Arjuna if one eats too much, eats too little, sleeps too much, or does not sleep enough. He who is regulated in his habits of eating, sleeping, recreation, work, can mitigate all material pains by practicing the yoga system. When the yogi, by practice of yoga, disciplines his mental activities and becomes situated in transcendence, devoid of all material desires, he is said to be well established in yoga. As a lamp in a windless place does not waver, so the transcendentalist whose mind is controlled always remains steady in his meditation on the transcendental self. In the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. One should engage oneself in the practice of yoga with determination and faith and not be deviated from the path. One should abandon without exception all material desires born of mental speculation and thus control all the senses on all sides by the mind. Gradually, step by step, one should become situated in trance by means of intelligence sustained by full conviction, and thus the mind should be fixed in the self alone and should think of nothing else. From whatever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it and bring it back under the control of the self. The yogi whose mind is fixed on me verily attains the highest perfection of transcendental happiness. He is beyond the mode of passion. He realizes his qualitative identity with the Supreme, and thus he is freed from all reactions to past deeds. So we see that many of these things that Krishna is saying could apply to the meditational system, and as well they could apply to the bhakti yoga system. Krishna is kind of speaking sort of in between the two systems, but I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. Thus, the self-controlled yogi constantly engages in yoga practice, becomes free from all material contamination, and achieves the highest stage of perfect happiness in transcendental loving service to the Lord. A true yogi observes in me all beings and also sees every being in me. Indeed, the self-realized person sees me, the Supreme Lord, everywhere. For one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I am never lost, nor is he ever lost to me. Such a yogi who engages in the worshipful service of the Supersoul, knowing that I and the Supersoul are one, remains always in me in all circumstances. He is a perfect yogi who, by comparison to his own self, sees the true equality of all beings, both in their happiness and distress, O Arjuna. So that's that whole section from 10 to 32, where Krishna is describing basically the yoga system, the dhyana yoga system. But as we were saying a minute ago, he could be describing the bhakti yoga system too. There are many parallels between the bhakti and the dhyana yoga system. Anybody have any questions about that part, the whole idea of the meditational yoga system as it's described in chapter 6 of Bhagavad Gita? Yeah.
I got stuck a little bit further back. So your mind affects your subtle body, which affects your physical body.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yeah.
How much does your subtle body affect your mind, or what happens if you lose your mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, the subtle body is, in fact, what we usually think of as our mind for the most part. The subtle body is our kind of suitcase full of our past mental habits and our past material desires and our self-conceptions of what we imagine we are. So that's basically, in one sense, what the subtle body is. And many times when we say the mind, that's really what we're talking about. So the subtle body, in that sense, subtle body equals mind. I've kind of made this point a little bit in our Brooklyn class, is that sometimes we use an analogy one way, and sometimes we use kind of a different analogy. But please don't be confused. We're talking about the same thing. We're just trying to use a different kind of analogy to bring out different aspects of it. So sometimes when we use the word mind, we mean something very specific. In this case, we really, for the most part, mean mind is the same thing as the subtle body. And so the subtle body is this collection of habits and desires and patterns. And that will cause us to move into the future in a particular way. But we are not helpless. We can change what we think about. And if we do, then we are also changing our future. And we're also changing what our mind will be in the future, because we are learning how to direct the mind. I'm not sure if I answered your question, so you tell me if I did or not, and if not, then give me something a little more detailed that I can understand to...
Sort of. I think I have to think about it a little more, because to me the subtle body is like what you come into this world with, your soul, kind of.
Uh-huh.
You know, your chakras and all.
Yeah, yeah.
But the mind to me is like your thoughts, and you're not necessarily your thoughts.
Yeah.
So
but
there's
a lot of stuff in the subtle body that's also not us, you know. Because the self, the pure self is the soul, and the pure self is a servant of Krishna. And the pure self is never under any misconceptions that any part of this material existence has any connection with us. That's the pure self. But most of us are not at all situated on that realization. So we do consider ourselves part of the material world. We do consider ourselves our body. We do consider ourselves our past habits, our thought patterns, our particular group of desires. We do identify with these, which is more than just our thought process. Our thought process is actually one of the things that can gradually be used to undo all this garbage that we have connected ourselves with. So that's why controlling the mind is so much stressed, because we have a thought pattern that's going through our mind at every time. We call it self-talk or whatever you want to call it. There's this idea of we have this internal dialogue going on, and that may be what you're referring to as the mind. And I can accept that. There's no problem with that. And that's one aspect of things that we are not. There are other things that we are not, too. But that part is very easy to understand, and it's very easy to be aware of. And so if we do control that part, we can control the other stuff too. And that's where it starts, by controlling that internal dialogue. That's one of the reasons why we chant Hare Krishna, you know, at least for those who of us who are initiated. We've taken a vow to chant 16 rounds every day, so that's 16 times 108. So we chant 108 beads on a string, and we chant all the way around 108 times, 16 times in a day. So for that time, which takes about 2 hours or 3 hours, depending on how fast you chant, for that time, you are trying to interrupt the usual mental dialogue. And what is it doing? You know, it's thinking this and that and the other. I saw this on television. That person said that. What's my boss going to say next week? Did I get that done? What about the laundry? You know, we got all these things bouncing back and forth. We're talking to ourselves. So we're interrupting that for a while. We're saying, okay, the currently scheduled program has been preempted by the Hare Krishna mantra. I'm afraid you'll have to tune in next week. And so we preempt the program for 2 hours, and we've got this other program playing, the Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. We're trying to drag it back. And of course, the mind is not at all happy about that. And the mind is saying, no, 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 no. My program is much better than this Hare Krishna program. Let me push the Hare Krishna program out of the way. And we say, no, no, I'm going to drag it back. And we, you know, it's a tug of war. And, you know, literally second by second, we're winning some, we're losing some, we're winning some, we're losing some. But we're struggling against the mind. And for the first time, we are actually coming to grips with this internal dialogue that's going 24/7 in our lives all the time. And so by chanting Hare Krishna, that is purifying that internal dialogue. And now the rudder of the ship is subtly starting to change its direction. And other things are happening too. As we do that, we become also aware that we are not this body. We become more and more aware that it's not just one of those cute things that Hare Krishna say because they read it in a book, but it's something we get a genuine experience of, that we are not the body. We are in a body, but we are not that body. We drive it around some kind of mysterious way. We're able to move it and make it act in a certain way, but we are not it. So that's the second thing that we aren't. Then we begin to realize that we're not our history either, and we're not all this other stuff, you know. All this stuff is like stuff that happens in a movie. You know, you're totally into it when you see the movie, you know, whatever the movie is, Gone with the Wind or Titanic or Avatar, whatever it is, Batman. And while you're there, you're totally identified with it. But when you walk out of the theater, you know, suddenly Batman is no longer in your mind so much, and all these other things are out of the way. So our life is, in one sense, like that. It's like a movie. We identify with it. But it also isn't us, because at the time of death, death proves to us it wasn't us, because all that gets stripped away in the course of a few moments. But this chanting gradually purifies the mind and redirects the mind. And then when the mind is redirected, the consciousness is redirected, and then the whole life becomes redirected. So all this happens, and that's why in these verses from about 5 to verse 9 in chapter 6, Krishna makes a point of saying that one needs to control the mind. The mind is the best friend or the worst enemy. Does that help a little bit? Or maybe
yeah,
there's...
Yeah, because But then where did the chakras come in? I mean, how physical is that? Is that... What happens to your chakras when you die?
Your chakras are a part of the subtle energy system of your body. That's your soul is not the chakras, but they're there. They're part of the subtle system. I'm not sure if they're a part of the subtle body or not. To be honest with you, that technicality I have never really run across, so I can't say they are, I can't say they're not. But maybe they are a part of the subtle body. But they are a part of the energy channel of your body. You can visit them when you're in the gross body. I'm not sure whether you're visiting them when you're in the subtle body.
So that's where, for me, it gets very confusing and I get stuck.
Well, chakras are only really important if you're doing the dhyana yoga system, you know. We can work with the chakras without actually visiting them. There's all this, you know, it's like a lot of people drive a car and never pop the hood. You know, they don't know what's going on in there. And because you don't know how the carburetor works or these crazy, you know, fuel injections these days with all the, you know, computer stuff that regulates everything. Because we don't know how it works, we can still use it, you know. And similarly, only a certain class of people actually pop the hood on everyday consciousness and begin to examine all the details of it. And those people are called yogis, you know. Usually we call them Astanga yogis just because now, right now, we're using the word yoga in a much more general sense, so I'm kind of using that qualifying term. They're Astanga yogis, people who learn. The whole idea of yama niyama and the first two aspects of yoga are to purify lifestyle. So yama is things we accept that usually we would want to reject for the sake of purification. Niyama is the other thing, things that we reject that we would normally accept. So by accepting certain things and rejecting other things, we purify our lifestyle. Because before you actually can start doing Astanga yoga, you have to have a purified lifestyle. Then you can perform hatha. And the purpose of hatha is to actually make the bodily limbs and the energy channels free enough and open enough that one can sit in one position for a long period of time and not fall asleep or have their limbs start to get the blood cut off in them and start to go to sleep or start to fidget or itch or move around or all those kind of things. That's what the whole purpose of hatha yoga is for, that when you drill the body back and forth, you're opening and closing these channels and moving the bodily limbs and the muscles and the joints and the bones in a certain way. And after a while, the body gets loose and able to sit comfortably in one position for long periods of time. That's like your rocket platform. Then you're ready to actually lift off, you know. Then the next stage is pranayama. Now you can comfortably sit in one place for a long period of time. And when you can comfortably sit in one place for a long time, you begin to be aware of life airs. The first one, most obvious one, is the one that comes in and out of the lungs. That's the biggest one, you know. But there are other life airs. There are, I think, six or eight major life airs, but then there are literally hundreds of minor ones. And these minor life airs, they have an effect on the internal workings of consciousness, how the consciousness connects to the body. And with those things, you basically are like a mechanic popping the hood on the car. And you can do things like stop your heart and not die. You can do things like stop breathing. You can do things like, be aware without going to sleep for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, you know, which you couldn't do in a normal consciousness. And eventually you begin to realize that not only can you control all these details of your body that you weren't even aware were possible to be controlled, you can begin to control things in the outside dimension as well. And that's where mystic powers start to come into the whole picture in the meditational yoga system. So all these things are connected. This body is like an avatar or like a material machine. But most of us drive it around without ever popping the hood. But yogis don't do that. They actually begin to come to the stage where they learn how to come to terms with those subtle dimensions that make who we are, that make our reality. And, of course, to get there, you really have to pay a heavy price. You have to be willing to be alone for huge lengths of time. You have to give up things. You have to be willing to be stationary for literally days and months and years. You know, if you can pay that kind of price and do it effectively, then you begin to be aware of the subtle dimensions that make our material universe work. And you can play with them if you want. And most people can't resist the temptation to do that. And then you become aware of the chakras, how they actually work. You can visit them and see what's going on there. And each one has a different function. And they are part of the energy channels that, work our physical body. And only really yogis do much with the chakras, you know. We deal with the chakras as bhakti yogis by trying to learn to give to Krishna. So we're opening the heart chakra, not in the same way a yogi does it. And that's where we get these parallels between what Krishna is saying in chapter 6, which is specific to the dhyana yoga system, and which actually has a parallel in the bhakti yoga system. Okay, maybe that's about all I can say about it. And any rate, we've kind of delved a little bit into the Ashtanga yoga system there. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, you mentioned that, you said when you lose the mind, something about losing the mind. Well, if you ever find yourself, if you get to that point, you should actually meditate on an empty stomach for maybe about an hour or however how long you feel.
That's an interesting.
Try to deal with the problem. Try to deal with the problem. And not take any psycho medication.
Oh, I wasn't talking about me.
No, I'm just saying, I mean, because you mentioned that some people tend to do that in a society.
I meditate on food if I meditate on empty stomach.
See, food could be an enemy. Food could be an enemy that you gotta, we have to control.
Are you suggesting a starball or crazy?
Yeah, that's it. Actually, I mean, that has actually worked. I've read some cases that people have been fasting to get rid of mental issues.
Okay, let me ask if there are any other questions about this section. And you had a question.
I'm sorry to take your time.
No, no problem.
I was just wondering about the nature of desire.
About what?
The nature of desire.
Desire.
Where does desires come from? For instance, some people have strong desires through sex.
Mm-hmm.
Other people have desires towards food.
Mm-hmm.
And other people have desires towards relationships.
Mm-hmm. Desire is the key, actually. More even than the mind, the desire is the thing that points us in a particular direction. But most people are not aware of what their desires are, and they're also not aware that they can change their desires. But one of the things I try to cover early in Bhagavad Gita is I talk about the concept of free will. Because of the concept of free will, then we begin to understand the ground of this world that we live in, you know, and that the Supreme Lord gives free will. The reason he does that is because if there was no free will, there could not be the voluntary giving of love, you know, otherwise love would be mandatory, and it would be the only possibility. But if there's a counter possibility to love, which means one cannot love, then we have truly free will. And for free will to exist, then love can exist. But for free will to exist, there has to be a place to express that free will. And that place is the material world. The spiritual world, everybody has free will, but they always express it in the desire to please Krishna. In other words, people in the spiritual world, they have one basic desire. And that one basic desire is they want to please Krishna. And of course, that's an abstract desire in one sense, because there's so many ways to please Krishna. And there's so many things one can do in relationship to Krishna. But when we desire to compete with Krishna, or why can't we be Krishna, then we get a chance to come here to the material world. We leave the spiritual world. And here, the material world opens up and gives us a whole smorgasbord of other things that we can think of to do besides please Krishna. And so we get this huge array of material possibilities. And we become attracted to certain ones of them. And so therefore we, like first year freshmen in college, we start choosing a major. We like this more and we like that less, and so we take more of this and less of that. And then over lifetimes, we begin to specialize in certain material desires that we identify as being more important to us than other material desires. Some people don't really even take that very much serious, and they just, whatever's right around them, they just do it. as long as it's materially stimulating to them in some kind of way. But, you know, we have all these general trends in the material world. Sex desire is the number one. You know, it's called the Adiras. It's the biggest, heaviest, hardest to deal with material desire of all of them. Then below that, we have, you know, all these other desires, you know, profit, adoration, distinction. We have desires for wealth. We have desires for fame. We have desires for various kinds of experiences. We have desires for material, physical objects, and so on and so forth. All these, you know, plethora of things we have, they're opening up to us as possibilities of things we can desire. And so we pick up these desires lifetime after lifetime. We specialize in them. And then we kind of make it our business in each incarnation to seek out those things which we have cherished as being the most important material desires life after life. And one lifetime, one time in that lifetime, we come to the realization that this is a stupid way to spend eternity, is chasing these kind of hollow material desires that never really amount to anything, and they never make us feel satisfied. And so the material desires are placed before us, and because we identify with them and then we think about them, we become locked into certain material desires. And oftentimes, we never finish with a material desire before we finish with a lifetime. And then when we come into a new incarnation, we come out as a little baby, and for at least 12 years, we struggle just to make the senses work. Then when we get about 13 or 14, the super soul reminds us of those things that we were so gung-ho on in the past lifetime, and we think, yeah, that's what I want to do. Now I've found myself. Now I know my dream. People talk about this, you know. So at a certain point later on in life, you know, we come into the realization of those particular bag of things that we have carried around for many lifetimes, that we have focused in on our major material desires. And then we just go for it. And, of course, this is a stupid thing that can just go on lifetime after lifetime after lifetime until one day we decide this is nuts. And I'm going to change it. But what do I do? Well, I have to learn how to have that same desire that people in the spiritual world have, that desire to only want to serve Krishna. How do I do that? A process called bhakti yoga, shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu, smaranam. By hearing, chanting, we gradually reprogram our consciousness, and the material desires gradually get phased out of our life, and a new set of desires, a new single desire begins to take over. Does that make sense? Can you follow that? Okay. Yeah, let me take Radha first. What were you going to say?
Do you think that the fundamental thing fueling our desires could be our basic desire for Krishna that we don't realize and that has been distracted and redirected towards other things? So we have this longing for Krishna, this original longing for Krishna, and we're being distracted by other things, and we're getting confused by our identification with our body. Mm-hmm. So we think, well, I'll feed my body, or I'll have sex, and I'll somehow satisfy that longing, but it's just misdirected longing.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, that's one way to look at it. We're just bouncing off the material world, and we're trying to do indirectly what we can do directly. It'll work directly, but it doesn't work indirectly. In the back, somebody had some.
Practices enhancing their senses to a point where certain things become repulsive to you. How do you ignore that?
Say that again.
When you enhance your senses to mm-hmm. like a point where you're picking up sounds and seeing things that you kind of learn to like be repulsed by it, certain sounds that you don't like or certain things that are not Krishna oriented, how do you ignore it?
So we're talking about a bhakti yogi.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what happens is that over time, our desires actually change. In the beginning, it's mentioned that, you know, there is some level of of just knowing what the right thing is and knowing what the wrong thing is, even though we still desire the wrong thing and we still don't desire the right thing. So in one sense, in the earlier stages of devotional life, we are doing some aspect of accepting things we aren't really too happy about and rejecting things we really wish we didn't have to reject. But over time, as Krishna consciousness develops and we develop purity, we find that our whole desire pattern becomes refurbished. It becomes actually changed over. And we begin to find that we actually like the things that we should like, and we're actually just not really interested in those things which we shouldn't like. You know, it actually begins that way. We were talking about that also a couple of days ago, you know, that there's this thing called a higher taste, you know. Vishaya vinavartante nira harasya dehinam rasovaryam rasopyasya param drishva nivartate. That the soul may be restricted, or the person may be restricted from sense gratification, but the taste for sense objects remains. But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, one is fixed in consciousness. So there comes a higher taste platform. And we talk about it. It doesn't come right away, but it does actually come on down the road. That if you stay with Krishna consciousness or spiritual life and purifying yourself, in the beginning, it is kind of a difficult go, because we are attracted by all kinds of things which we know we shouldn't be attracted by. But in the long run, we find that we lose our attraction for those. We experience a higher taste. So one has to hang on for a while. Arjuna asks that question a minute here in chapter 6. He asks the question of what happens to the unsuccessful yogi. You know, that it seems like, what if you try for this spiritual life and then you don't actually make the grade? You know, so here you've given up material stuff, which wasn't easy to do. And you didn't make the spiritual grade either, so do you get the worst of both worlds? What happens to such a person? That's Arjuna's second question in chapter 6, but we haven't quite gotten there. And then Krishna explains what happens. But, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I just like, when you...
Are you saying you're agitated by a certain thing?
Right, exactly. Certain things start to agitate you because they interrupt your consciousness, which is, you know, everyday life. How do you get past that point?
Well, you know, one of the things we have to always recognize is the material world is never going to be what we want it to be. And one of the purposes of the material world is to try to, you know, agitate us. It's kind of designed to do that. And once you recognize that it's not an unnatural or out of the ordinary situation that something or someone or the world around you is trying to agitate you, it's actually kind of a common thing. It happens a lot. Then you can kind of try to catch yourself and recognize that, why should I really be so much agitated by this? Let me just continue. And then you kind of watch what your mind is focusing on. If you're really agitated by things, one technique that really helps is to change your breathing patterns. You know, that if you find yourself disturbed, agitated, or emotionally wrought up over something, if you just force yourself to breathe very slowly for a while, that you will find that your consciousness will automatically kind of subside. You know, it's a simple technique. And I was surprised that even the American military teaches this technique to people, that if you're going into a war zone, and probably there's not much that's more agitating than that, that's probably the creme de la creme of agitating situations. If you're going into a situation like that, they teach soldiers that you have to actually be very careful about the way you breathe. And so if you breathe in one way, you will allow that agitation to become more and more, you'll amplify it. And if you breathe very slowly, you'll de-amplify it. And that's called, what do they call that in military training? They call it arousal modification, I think, is a term for it, or something like that. So at any rate, maybe that'll help. But that's another thing that I thought I'd toss in there. Any other questions? We'll move on to the next section. Arjuna asks two questions here in Chapter 6. The first question he asks is, after Krishna has explained all this stuff about meditational yoga, he's explained all these details, the first thing Arjuna says is, gee whiz, I don't think I can do it. And actually, that's exactly what Krishna wanted him to have the realization of, you know, that here, Arjuna has suggested back in Chapter 2 that maybe he should go to the forest, I guess ostensibly to meditate. Now, Krishna didn't say, Arjuna, don't meditate. Instead, he said, okay, you want to meditate? Here's what it's about. This is what you do. You sit down, kusha grass, seats not too high, not too low. You stare at the tip of the nose. You're free from sex life. You just focus on your breathing and, you know, on and on. He's explaining all these details. And then after Krishna's explained that all the way to verse 32, then in verse 33, Arjuna says, O Madhusudan, the system of yoga you have summarized appears impractical and unendurable to me, for the mind is restless and unsteady. That's Arjuna's, you know, reaction to hearing about this yoga system. And basically, that's what Krishna wanted him to understand, you know, that it's not practical in this day and age. Why is it not practical in this day and age? Anybody have any idea?
Well, we need to go to walk. I mean, we need to relaxing under a tree.
But you don't have to meditate for the whole entire. You can do it in.
But that's not the way the yoga system is supposed to do. People actually meditated not for just hours, but they meditated for years. In yoga, people meditate. They live for 100,000 years, and people would spend 60,000 of those 100,000 years meditating. So, you know, it's not practical in our day and age. You know. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Shorter
lifetime. Yeah. So in Satyuga, it was practical. In Satyuga, there was no business. People didn't punch time clocks. There was no need for government. There was no need for organized ways of making a living. People made their living off the land, and they didn't even need much, you know. And that's why it was practical to meditate for a long time. You wouldn't have to call in sick and tell your boss, well, I can't make it to work today, I'm meditating, so please excuse me, you know. You could go on meditating for huge lengths of time, and nothing was hampered by that. But of course, because the material world has to give us options, various flavors of material options, that one set of options gradually segues into another set of options, gradually segues into another set of options. So the options that were available in Satyayuga are no longer available, but a new set of options was available in what we call Treta Yuga. And in Treta Yuga, now we have to have government. Now we have to have, you know, kind of organization. And now people actually have developed material desires. You see, in Satyayuga, people are not very developed in their material desires. They can, you know, if you have a house, if you have a hut and you live there with your wife and you're performing some yajnas all day long, you don't think, well, gee whiz, I don't have an iPad or something like that. You know, I really need to get a flat screen or something. You don't think like that. You think, what else do I need? I've got something to eat. I'm living. But because only very more materially purified people can actually exist in that kind of environment, gradually time segues into what we call Treta Yuga. And in Treta Yuga, people actually start making more specific plans for specific material desires. And now we see more details of material desires come into the picture. And now we have to have a government. Now we have to have organization. And now we have the beginning of what we call the Varna system. We have brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras. Some people are qualified as teachers. Some are qualified as soldiers and administrators. Some are qualified as merchants and agrarians and bankers and things like that. And then we have some people who just fill in the gaps. And then with Dwapara Yuga, now we have far more material desires being available. And now people are very specific about their material desires. And no one could meditate, even in Treta Yuga or Dwapara Yuga. It's not very practical. What to speak of now in Kali Yuga, when people are very agitated, they live very short. Their whole lifespans are about very specific material desires. And the world is designed to make very specific material desires possible. And for those very specific material desires to be possible, one has to work in a very specific way. So that's why, as you know, this one devotee was telling us here, you can't because you have to go to work. You know, so people have to go to work because they have specific material plans, specific material desires, and therefore the whole thing works together, and it's not practical to meditate.
But you got to find time to do it.
Well, you can meditate in between times, but that's not actually the Ashtanga Yoga system. You know, you can certainly. I'm not saying meditation isn't good for you. It is. So is yoga. But physically good, but it's not a spiritual path in itself the way it once was. You can't use it as a spiritual path because you can't actually spend the amount of time doing it that would make it practical to achieve the goal that you want. If you kind of drop out of your job, you build some kind of nest egg, or you can somehow move to India and manage to stay afloat there and meditate for years and years and years, then maybe you could start getting towards the actual physical, you know, qualifications necessary to perform yoga the way it's intended to be performed. Yeah.
You know, I've heard it spoken of before where there was a time when people lived for 100,000 years. I mean, what our minds can comprehend is somebody living to maybe 100 and barely hanging on at mm-hmm. that point. But this thing about living to 100,000 years, I mm-hmm. mean, there's no documentation, no... Mm-hmm. I mean, I...
Even the Bible talks about that. You know, it's interesting.
About people living for 100,000
yeah,
years?
Yeah, the Bible talk. It gives all these ages of some of the Old Testament prophets that were 800, 700 years. You know, you get this sense that people lived a longer time. However, there's one catch to that, and that is that however long you live, to yourself, it appears you're living 100 years. You know, so in the heavenly planets, people live for hundreds of thousands of years, but to them, they feel like they're living 100 years. Brahma lives 411 trillion years of our time, but to him, he's living 100 years. So there's a kind of a relativization time, you know. So although you are, compared to somebody else, you're living huge amounts of time, compared to yourself, you feel like you have a lifespan that's 100 years.
So we're not talking about, like, real time then?
Well, yes, we are. We are. That, you know, the... comparative time. Time is relativized. So to the individual, he's experiencing it as if it was going by at the same rate you're experiencing your life going by. And for that matter, the ephemera, the little fly that lives, you know, it's born in the morning, it dies before the sun sets, you know. It feels like it lives 100 years too, you know, but it's mm-hmm. sped up. But for us, we can live through hundreds of lifetimes of the ephemera. And similarly, the demigods live through hundreds of our lifetimes. We each experience life on the same spectrum, on the same relative kind of a spectrum. But this has been talked about in the Vedic literatures a lot, you know, that there are different time periods. And in different time periods, physics works a little differently in each different time period. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, so the concept of the year is rotation around the sun. So are you suggesting that that rotation keeps increasing, and like the speed keeps increasing? So like 1 year 1,000 years ago was faster, was mm-hmm. slower than 1 year now?
Maybe. I had, to be honest with you, I never thought of it that way. But we find that also in different planets, time is relative. You know, that, excuse me, in the higher planets, time goes by much faster. In Brahma's planet, the time seems to go by the same way it does here. But two are not, it's kind of like Einstein's, you know, relativity equation, you know, that as you travel closer to the speed of light, time slows down. It's the same concept. That the story goes that Maharaj Indradyumna, he wanted to build a huge temple for Lord Jagannath. So he made an effort to have this big temple constructed. And then he thought, who would be the perfect person to inaugurate the temple but Lord Brahma? So Indradyumna went to Brahma's planet to ask Brahma if he would come and be the inaugurator of his big temple for Lord Jagannath. So when he got to Lord Brahma's planet, Brahma was watching some dancing program that was going on in Brahma Loka. And so naturally Indradyumna waited till the program was over, and then he asked Lord Brahma, my dear Brahma, would you please come? I have arranged for a big temple to be built in Orissa, and I would like you to be the person to inaugurate it. And Brahma says, certainly I'll come. He said, when do you plan to do it? He said, well, we had hoped to open the temple next month. And then Brahma laughed. And Indradyumna thought, why is he laughing? And he said, you don't know that since you've been here for a few minutes, thousands of years have gone by on Earth. No one even knows who you are now. Nobody even remembers the history of your reign. And so when Indradyumna went back, everybody, it was a whole new group of people there, you know. So he was with Brahma for only a few minutes, but meanwhile, literally thousands of years had gone by here on the Earth planet. Yeah.
I wanted to mention, I noticed a study that was highlighted in a, you know, Journal of Science, and it claims that metabolic rate and body size are linked with perception of temporal information.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, which is really fascinating because it, you know, correlates with this concept.
Yeah. So time is relative.
Yeah, so that for animals, you know, like, they also experience, like, what it's putting forward is that, you know, animals' perception, like a dog who lives for, you know, 15 years, is experiencing that length of time as
100 years of dog life, yeah.
So
we have that way of talking about
dogs,
dog years.
Yeah, we correlate, but there's actually some reality to it.
Yeah.
So.
It is also correlated with the heart rate, because the heart rate of cats and dogs is much faster than ours.
That might be, too.
Somebody said that has something to do with how the lifespans are lived faster, therefore their heart rates are much faster.
So, Arjuna, he asks this question, you know, that this yoga system is unendurable for me. And Krishna replies, no, that yoga can be done, but if it's done properly. This is how Krishna answers that question, you know. Arjuna goes on further. He says, for the mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong, O Krishna, and subdue it, I think, is more difficult than controlling the wind. So if you ever have trouble controlling the mind here, Arjuna is having trouble controlling the mind. So what to speak of us, you know. And then Krishna says, O mighty armed son of Kunti, it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by suitable practice and by detachment. For one whose mind is unbridled, self-realization is difficult work. But he whose mind is controlled and who strives by appropriate means is assured of success. That is my opinion. And then Arjuna asks his second question. O Krishna, what is the destination of the unsuccessful transcendentalist who in the beginning takes to the process of self-realization with faith, but later desists due to worldly mindedness and does not attain perfection in mysticism? O mighty arm Krishna, does not such a man, bewildered from the path of transcendence, fall away from both spiritual and material success and perish like a riven cloud with no position in any sphere? So that's Arjuna's second question, you know. First, Krishna explains his whole nuts and bolts of the material meditational yoga system. And Krishna, Arjuna says, I don't think I can do it. It's unpractical, unendurable, because the mind is so difficult. And then Krishna says, no, it is possible by suitable practice and detachment. And then Arjuna asks his second question, well, so what happens to somebody who tries to engage in the process of spiritual life, but they fail? Don't they get the worst of both worlds? They didn't enjoy in the material world, they gave up material stuff, and they didn't make it to the spiritual world either. So don't they lose out big time? You know. And Krishna says, no. This is how Krishna answers. Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O son of Pritha, a transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activity does not meet with destruction either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil. The unsuccessful yogi, after many years of enjoyment on the planet of the pious living entities, is born into a family of righteous people or into a family of rich aristocracy. So, if you try to be a spiritual bhakti yogi and you don't quite make it, then you'll wind up in the heavenly planets for a while. And then after that, you come back to the material earth planet in either a very wealthy family, or if you've been engaged in yoga for a long time, you'll come into the earthly plane, into a family of already bhakti yogis. So you get the chance to pick up from where you left off. You don't have to go all the way from ground zero. So in other words, you get the chance to continue the progress that you made in a previous life. So in this way, you don't lose out.
But doesn't that kind of, I guess it's merciful, but it kind of lets us off the hook in terms of, like, if you're not successful in the material world and you're not successful in the spiritual world, you're like, oh well, I'll just go to the heavenly planets for a while. So it kind of, it eases the stress of it all, or it just kind of lets us off the hook in pursuing spiritual life maybe more. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you could think of it that way. If you think being in the heavenly planets is something worth doing, we recognize that being in the heavenly planets means you may have a long lifetime, a great, powerful body, and you may enjoy in certain ways that we can't even dream of here, but it's still temporary, it's still material. And that the only thing that satisfies the heart in a deep sense is a relationship with the Supreme, even if you're in the heavenly planets. So if actually that's what you would prefer, then yeah, maybe it's a great thing to go to the heavenly planets. But anyone who's a serious bhakti yogi knows that that's not worth having. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a booby prize for us, like the little, whistle in the back of box of Cracker Jacks or something like that, All right, we get to go to the heavenly planets. All right, when is this done so I can get back to becoming involved in genuine spiritual life, So it's kind of a booby prize for us. Yeah?
Yeah, you were saying this actually very important to me. So you saying that, me being a beginner on it, not interested in any of that at all.
Uh-huh.
Because realizing that it'll eventually, it's temporary, it'll end anyway.
Continue chanting, engage in service, work together with devotees, help spread Krishna consciousness. All these things are part of the whole bhakti system. If you continue with those, you will gradually be purified and your consciousness will become elevated to the point of being able to go back home, back to Godhead. If not in this life, immediately following in the next one. So I'm going to wrap it up here with just, so Krishna asks I mean, Arjuna asked the first question, Krishna answered it. He asked the second question about what happens to the unsuccessful yogi, and Krishna answered that. And we learn that if the unsuccessful yogi has just started the process, then he comes back in the family of wealthy parents. If he's actually gone more in his progress of spiritual life, then he comes back in a family of transcendentalists, so that already from the very beginning he has the knowledge and the right circumstance to make progress in spiritual life very quickly. So that all makes sense, you know, that actually you get what you want. If you really want spiritual life, then Krishna helps to set the stage for you to be able to get it. In some ways, if you really want some material thing, then Krishna also sets up that stage, so you can eventually get whatever material thing that you want. So most of us have come to the realization that we want something spiritual, so either in this life or in immediate lives to follow, we will get a spiritual connection. And the more sincerely we try for it, the quicker it'll come. And then at the very end, Krishna describes that of all tapas vibhyo diko yogi jnanibhyo pimato mataha karmibhyo cha diko yogi tasmad yogi bhavarjuna. So that's what Krishna is telling Arjuna. Better, the yogi is better than the ascetic or the tapasvi. The yogi is better than the jnani, or the person who just tries to speculate about spiritual knowledge. The yogi is better than the karmi, or the one who just does pious Vedic activity for material gratification. So therefore, Arjuna, you should be a yogi. And then he finally says what kind of yogi he should be. That he should be a yogi that always meditates, rather always serves. So we have Yoginam api sarvesham madgatena antaratmanam shradavam bhajate yomam same yuktatamo mataha. That of all yogis, one who meditates, one who abides in me, thinking of me within himself, renders transcendental loving service to me, he is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So the word bhaj is used, service, rather than dhyan or meditation. So that yogi is not a meditational yogi, but a serving yogi or a worshiping yogi. And that is what Krishna has in mind for Arjuna. And then with chapter 7, which you'll get into next week with somebody else, chapter 7 launches into Krishna speaking directly about devotional service. From 7 through chapter 12, Krishna talks about devotional service. So that's the middle six chapters, sometimes called the heart of the Gita. That's where Krishna is not beating around the bush talking about other systems. Now he's talking directly about bhakti yoga, and he's explaining to Arjuna how to do it. Any other final questions? I did wind up going through all that one.
Yeah.
I didn't think I would, but I did.
Do you need more?
No, I think I'm hydrated sufficiently at this point. Okay, so we're going to do a final kirtan?
Yeah, so if nobody has any other questions, then let's give it up for Tom Shankar Swami. What a wonderful class. And if you want to catch more, we've got a really intimate, really wonderful Bhagavad Gita class on Mondays every week. I almost hate to mention it because it's like the best kept secret in New York next to this program, you know. So, but I said it.
7:30 in Brooklyn.
7:30. Lucy knows. She goes.
Yeah. 7:30 Brooklyn Temple.
Yeah. And there's always food too. So you don't have to meditate on food and eat it and get it over
empty
with.
Stomach or any of those kind of agitating situations.
Yeah. And we'll have one more kirtan, and then an amazing prasadam piece prepared by Bhakta Matthew. So.